Oh, well, it's nothing.
You're very welcome.
I enjoyed doing it. I got a few licks in for Von Braun, but and remind me to mention the Today Show of this morning. But tell me, the story you were going to.
I just popped in my mind.
If you don't mind, I'm
no.
As a backup.
When we had when we used to use lantern slides, and we'd go to Washington. I went one trip with Werner Von Braun and Herman Kulle. Remember Herman Kulle, who was the head of the Future Projects?
Right.
And we were going to Washington to make one of the presentations we made to ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, which, as you may remember, funded the early days of the Saturn program. It was funded by ARPA.
That's what I recall.
And that went on, I think, in 58, and then eventually the funding was turned over to NASA because ARPA didn't have any real mission for it. But ARPA got the Saturn program started.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Dick Canright was the main figure over at ARPA in those days.
And was that actually pre-NASA? Obviously,
absolutely
it was pre-NASA.
Pre-Marshall,
but
well,
pre-NASA,
pre-NASA, because I think it was April 58. Not too much pre-NASA,
but
pre-NASA. Yeah.
I remember ARPA, yeah.
Anyway, the main story that I just popped into my mind, we carried a lantern slide, which was, I guess, 4x5, kind of, each was heavy glass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we used instead of slides in those days.
Oh, like the garrotites.
We carry them up in these great big boxes, wooden boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was out, this is one of the trips I made with Von Braun when I was working for him. And I guess we were Army Ballistic Missile Agency then, not NASA, it was before NASA.
Right.
We were still Army Ballistic Missile Agency, making the presentation. And Herman Kulle was on this side of this table, and I was on the other side of the table, and we had the projector here, and Von Braun was wherever he was, but Roy Johnson was the main recipient. Roy Johnson was the first director of ARPA, and he was the recipient of this. And
was that doctor? Was he a doctor or not?
No, doctor was, I forgot. And anyway, Herman Kulle was putting the ladder slide into the little place where it goes, you know,
puts
in, and then I would pull it out and take the ladder slide out and put it over here. So that's how we did it, because it was very bulky in those days. And Verna was talking, and we got through maybe 10 or 15 lantern slides. And Verna said, and now we have another project, Mr. Johnson, we'd like to review with you. So we change of scene. So Herman Kulle puts this in, and everybody's aghast. It was a totally naked woman standing there like that with her arms out. And Roy Johnson was puzzled at first, you know, but he looked at the face of Kulle, who was a very proper guy.
Yes.
And Roy Johnson started to howl and laugh because he knew that it was a trick. Somebody played a trick on him. And Von Braun was puzzled at first, but then we all get what is the last. I don't think Herman ever did laugh. So that was one of the lantern slides.
Who had done that?
We never. A man named Gerd de Beek.
Okay. I remember that name.
Graphics office. I don't think anybody ever messed up to it.
But somebody had, I mean, not a member of your party.
Oh, absolutely not. That was very clear to Roy Johnson, especially looking at Herman Kulle's face. Yeah, that was funny.
And it was a bit of levity to it.
Yeah, that's right. It was a nice, and we went on the other project. I forgot what he said now. I hadn't even thought of that in years, that little story.
Oh, that is funny. I had not heard that before. Tom Wolfe was on the Today Show for the second time.
On his new book?
On his new book.
Yeah.
And Katie Kerr, I caught him last week, so this maybe it was taped, and then this is the second part. Katie Couric asked him I didn't turn it on. I got out of the shower or something and didn't turn it on until mid-segment. But Barbara told me she had heard it. She was in the kitchen. That Katie Couric had asked Wolf, what about John Glenn, and you know, you wrote the right stuff and all of that, and isn't he quite the hero, and what do you think about that? And apparently Wolf said, well, Glenn certainly made his contribution to it, and this is fine, but the real hero of the space program is Wernher von Braun. That he was NASA's, this is about the time I came in, he was NASA's only philosopher, and that von Braun had this vision, this lofty philosophical view of space exploration and he said that when the sun dies, which Oriana Falaci took as her book title, and from an interview with him, when the sun dies, if this species, which is the only known intelligent, higher intelligence life form, although there may be others, but the only known, we have to have a new home. Mm-hmm. And so there is a long range, ultra long range. But Tom Wolfe, really, he said virtually the same thing when he appeared here last year at the Viva La Libra. We have an annual big deal dress up, not black tie, but dressy fundraiser for Huntsville Public Library. 600 people come and pay up to $300 or $400 a couple at maxing out to rub elbows with the speaker. But Wolf, being in Space City, really lauded von Braun, and he said, I've never been in the von Braun Center before. He said von Braun was NASA's only philosopher.
I've got to keep that. Did you get a transcript of that?
I don't know. They should have. I'm ordering a transcript, I hope through the local NBC affiliate, of his remarks this morning.
Oh, good.
Because I may want to quote it. But I took notes. I whipped out during the dinner on the key remarks about von Braun.
Yeah.
But he's quite a fan of von Braun. I began to wonder, is this guy going to do his own take on von Braun in a biography or something?
Yeah. It's interesting. We talked about Tom Wolf and Buzz Aldrin. Buzz Aldrin was he's the chairman of the board of directors of our National Space Society. And
I see.
Hugh Downs is the chairman of the board of governors. We had a joint meeting in Florida at the time of the Glenn landing. And we got, I don't know how it was, I think Hugh Downs is sitting on this side, Buzz Aldrin sitting around the court. We just kind of, we're about 15, I guess, at the table, but we got a little conversation at this end of the table. And somehow, the name Tom Wolf came up about his new book. And Aldrin's, that book is his, that right stuff. But it's just, he was wrong in so many places. And so we did.
All the astronauts don't think much. Pete Conrad, of course, who I'm told, we're all told, was the secret primary source for Wolf on that.
Yeah.
Pete was in that first batch of Mercury nominees and got cut.
Got cut, right.
But he was in on all the medical and psychological screening, and with his intellect and great sense of humor, he made a wonderful source for Wolf.
Yeah.
It is alleged. I don't think Conrad has ever acknowledged that.
The deep throat for
I found it really interesting that Miss Couric wanted to talk about John Glenn and Tom Wolfe wanted to talk about von Braun.
That is very interesting. Gotta hope you keep that and try to get that. You don't need those remarks to tape. I would be surprised if a big function like that would the library have taped them?
Yes. Would you like me to check on that? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't need to have it, but I think if we should want to, guys like you and me should have it.
You're right. I said, I took my...
But I could use something like that.
Yeah.
For another edition of the biography or something for one of the flyers.
I'll get that.
I mean, that would be very
I feel sure they did. This past session they had, and God, I'm trying to remember if it was summer or fall, early fall or spring, John Barrett, Barrent, the Midnight in the Garden of Evil, that phenomenal New York.
Right.
He spent so much of his time with Esquire, I think. But he did that wonderful book on nonfiction on Savannah. Mm-hmm. He came and spoke and for the 98 version of this library fundraiser. Mm-hmm. They get top people.
Yeah.
Pat Conroy came and mm-hmm. was wonderful. And going back a lot, Irving Stone and Art Buchwald.
Oh, you really got it, man.
And they really, and Mark Russell came mm-hmm. 1 year and was quite entertaining.
Oh, very interesting.
So they have top notch and they pay whatever the going fee is for these folks.
Uh-huh.
So
the library still makes some money.
They make tons of money off mm-hmm. of it. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, Wolf charmed the whole crowd and you could tell he was sincere about Mark Brown.
That is great. I love to hear this.
I will see if I can get a transcript. Surely they recorded his remarks.
Yeah, it'd be nice to get, or even get the extract of those remarks. Of course, you could borrow the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And you could pick out the
sure
part that was more than, you know. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to have that. End of the radio interview, it was call in. There was a voice called in from somewhere, you know, metropolitan Boston. It was a thick accent, very critical. I figured he's probably a hold, probably one of the camps, something like that, at the top of the ground. But in general, that didn't happen to me. I was on Larry King when he was radio for 3 hours. When he did his midnight radio business, I was remember that all the comments that came in were very positive. I was on a Dick Cavett show.
Larry King, I mean, all the call-in comments were positive.
All positive.
Yeah.
I remember, and that's before the problems began with Ron Brown and some of his associates.
Right.
And the other thing I remember, I did a Dick Cavett show, which is kind of interesting. They asked me to do a half-hour show in New York, so I went to where he was doing his program, and they had an audience there.
Boy, he had a great show.
And I did my half-hour, and then, much to my surprise, it was taped, but there was a live audience. Then, much to my surprise, he announced that I would be back again soon. And then the curtains closed. He said, by soon, I mean in about a half an hour. Is that okay with you? That's the second show, which will probably be aired maybe a week later.
Sure.
And in between, I've been waiting while we were waiting to go on. He did quite a bit of taping in one day. Yehudi Menuhin was the next guest in between my first and second. So we got to talk to you.
Oh, wonderful.
And he had an English wife. And she was very interested in this because she had been in London during the
Beatles. Oh,
so we had that little thing going on. And then I went back out on the stage, and he said, and we now reviewed a little bit about what had happened sometime in the past, obviously. And now we're delighted to have Frederick Broadway, co-author of The Rocket Team. I think he was doing The Rocket Team for Christmas period. Back with us again, you know, like it had been months later. And we had another show. And I remember his comments were very, everything was just very positive. I didn't run into much in those days of antagonism to Ron Brown.
Mm.
But after he retired, after the team had retired and he was up and away from the limelight, and particularly after he had died, the attacks began.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether they've been latent or nobody dared do it when he was a hero and taking astronauts to the moon and so forth, or whether it's the kinds of things that you would expect from from younger generation scholars. This is happening in Germany, I understand, from German friends of mine, young German friends of mine. I have a very good friend who's on the Cassini project, who's from the University of Berlin, but he's assigned as a and he says that people of his generation, he's probably 25, this was a new attitude, a younger people, anybody that worked for Hitler.
Mm-hmm. In this era of political correctness,
yeah.
And
A naivete, because you know, they don't understand what it was like working in the dictatorship. And that is something that von Braun used to address when he was speaking, particularly after Sputnik. He would have said, I want you to all discount the fact that things, you can't do specific projects or do certain things if you put all your mind to it under the confining situation of a dictatorship. It's not the way to do science, and the long run is counterproductive. But and then he said, look what happened in Germany, for example. Did some incredible scientific developments. Put your entire attention to it, give it the highest priority, so don't underestimate the Russians, was his measure. He said, I've lived through a dictatorship and we were able to do some things, not that we didn't like it that way, we wouldn't want it that way, but you can do those things in a dictatorship.
Sure.
He didn't hide that he, you know, at all.
I know I'm going to be educated more on that point. I am reading your and Ernst's book, and then we'll be back in touch maybe for some attributed excerpts from that.
I'd be glad to. I haven't read the book in a while. You sort of don't really remember what's in it. Without manuscript, it was much too long.
Ernst told me that there were 600 pages
I turned over
discarded.
To Space and Rockets out of these, and the complete type manuscript, which is in three volumes, you know, with 400 or 500 pages every time. But the same thing happened to the rocket.
Sure. Well, you
said you want to sell two copies, or 200, or 2,000, or whatever.
And that's the practical reality of it. But y'all, you in both instances, y'all, you were trying to do definitive works.
I don't know
something
whether
has
what
to
the,
go.
The, you remember the old autograph story that von Braun used to like to tell?
Tell me, remind
well, this
me about
came up down at, with Hugh Downs. We got to talk about autographs. We were in the restaurant. We were at the Mango Tree restaurant. I think you probably went there at the Cape one time. And when the lady, we had organized it through the National Space Society. That would be a dinner for the National Space Society. And the lady, my wife and I were out first to make sure everything was okay, the table's all right, all right. And she said, I guess we'd, what, we said we wanted a table, I think the secretary of the society said we wanted a room by, sort of by ourselves, that we would have some distinguished people. I guess she mentioned I was always going to be there in the presence of this company and Hugh Downs. Hugh Downs seemed to pay more attention than Charles Alden, because he goes in so much.
Right.
And the lady who owns the restaurant, she said, you think you're going to get my daughters, I have my two daughters here, and they just love Hugh Downs. And I asked Hugh, and she said, no, he wouldn't mind at all, so they brought a manual and they signed it. And then Hugh, we got to talk about autographs and how Alden has some stories. And then one von Braun story, I'll tell you that one, and then I'll tell you what Hugh's. On one occasion, von Braun used to like to tell the story. And I don't know if he had this in the book or not, I really can't remember. When he was asked to, I think a group of teenage girls after a lecture came up to him, Dr. von Braun, because he was a hero in those days.
Oh, sure.
And one girl said, Dr. von Braun, could I have two autographs? And von Braun said, well, yes, and signed two cards, but why do you want two? She said, well, for two of yours, I can trade for one of Elvis Presley. So Hugh Downs said, well, I'll tell you what happened to me. Well, I was with after a program, and a lot of young girls came up, and they asked for the maybe boys, too, but young people.
I had heard that Elvis Presley thing, but I don't think I've heard of Hugh Downs.
And Hugh said, he said, okay, that's all enough. You have to put an end to it. And also a little boy came up. A little guy coming up, he says, oh, excuse me, sir, could I have an autograph? You know, this little pint-sized kid,
right.
Knows his way in there. And so he said, okay, little kid. So he signed his name. The little kid looked at it and said, Huge Downs. Oh, who is that?
Huge Downs.
This
is action, and I'm ashamed to this day that I did it. I happened to be at the Cape pre-launch in some sort of lobby area, and I can't remember if it was a NASA facility or the hotel, the motel where we were right now. But Von Braun came in, and people descended on him. Civilians for interviews, and there were some 8x10 glossies around, so it makes me think it was a NASA thing. But so with, I mean, you could tell he was, it was kind of long suffering on his part. He stopped and he signed just his signature, and I was right there, and stupidly I was overcome by the thought that, gosh, you know, I'm covering this guy. I don't even have an autographed picture from him. Not thinking, Lord, God damn. I mean, when you get back home, maybe you could send a request. He could do it at his leisure or something. And so I kind of bellied up to the group and with a picture and handed it to him. He gave me the most pained look that, and yet he went ahead and did it. I mean, he was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
Look, you know I'm not enjoying this. I can do you something.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And I accepted it and have since lost it, which is poetic justice.
Yeah.
I have letters from him and things like that, but I was instantly ashamed that I had done that, but I was just caught up in the frenzy, the celebrity frenzy around him. And I mean, I used poor judgment. It was a very small thing, but I've not gotten over the shame of doing it. But yeah, I think he forgave me.
Well, you know, he did have pictures signed, which when he would write in for picture. And this is interesting because I just before I left Washington, I got a letter from a person. I get lots of letters because of the books, and people know I was associated with it and so forth. And he wrote me, he said, I have a picture autographed by Von Braun, but I suspect it was autocad. And he said he had taken it,
wanted you to authenticate it.
Well, he was wondering if I could find it on my archives, you know, a real picture is what he wanted. And I get a lot of letters like this, and people ask him anything with this handwriting on it, anything, you know. And I just said, like, you know, I don't have it. I mean, I have a huge amount of stuff with this, all his edits of the books we did together, and so on.
Sure.
Enormous stuff. But, you know, I'm not going to sell on Brahms. Signature, but the people, there are collectors out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to pay for it, but they're out there.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy was worried that it's an auto pen.
And
apparently there is a way, I think the auto pen has an absolute standard pressure on the paper, whereas if you do it yourself, it's
going to
be a variable press, something like that. I don't think I'd ever worry about that, but I guess the purist do.
Sure.
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting. But anyway, that's a little piece of shame I will take to my grave that I fell into that mode.
You do those things sometimes.
Sure, it was just impulse.
I've asked Buzz on several occasions to sign. He'll sign my thing for me, of course, but for books, you know, I've bought one of his books, and of course he loves to sign that. But a little card for one of my wife's nephews just loves something. I said, do you mind? Well, sure, Fred. Okay, for Diego, you know, that's where she was.
Mm-hmm.
I said, let's go. We did that on this trip, actually. We went to Bernard Surf. You probably know.
Oh, one. I remember that so well.
They have a picture of
buffalo
a,
meat.
Yeah, they
sharp.
They have a picture of like this format, sidewise, of a woman, a naked woman, facing the other side. You see her part, you know.
Right.
And that they use that as their card now, Bernard Surf. So I go grab one of those, and I said to Buzz, my son, to Diego, and I said, he's one of your great admirers in South America. I do things like that occasionally, because I know the guy.
Sure.
But, autographs is a...
I treasure a huge framed poster put out, it was either by NASA or the Space and Rocket Center, I think it was Space, on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of Apollo 11,
And Governor Hunt called me up, and I didn't know Governor Hunt except as a journalist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But some Buck B or somebody had given him my name. This is in 88.
Uh-huh.
Bob, I know you have this interest in the space program, and you active with the chamber. Would you chair as a part of the Alabama reunion in 89, a space celebration? It's going to be a statewide event, but it'll be centered in Huntsville, and it'll coincide with the 20th anniversary of Apollo 11. And he said, we have no budget, no staff, and no plans for that celebration, but would you do that? And I said I would, and I spent months and months on of spare time and times time. But in the end, completely as a surprise, the Space and Rocket Center presented me with this poster, gorgeous thing, and it was autographed. We did get Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins here, and two of their wives,
mm-hmm.
And they autographed, I don't know whether they did 20 or 40 or 50 or 12 mm-hmm. or whatever, all three together, which is fairly unusual.
Oh, that's good.
So, that, and I know that's authentic.
Yeah.
And it was there was some personalization of it to me, which was nice. Just as my little reward for
sure. Having done well, you know, those things fetch big prices.
Yeah, I have no idea.
There's a company in Santa Monica called Superior Stamp and Coin, I think, auctioneers.
Mm-hmm.
But they have taken it upon themselves in the last, I guess, 10 years to auction huge quantities of material from the astronauts and others.
Oh, is that right?
Including the Russians or something. Mm-hmm. And all the astronauts are, you know, selling all the stuff that they've got.
Sure.
And they fetch big prices. There are catalogs. I have a complete set of watches, and I know there are copies out of the Space and Rocket Center. So sometimes you want to go up in the archives, ask Irene who's there, to show you one of the Superior catalogs.
Okay.
And you can get it. Hmm. And that's interesting for you. I would bring it up, not that you're going to sell it, but that you will
right.
find a valuation on it for your mm-hmm. insurance coverage.
Mm-hmm. That's a good
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
Because it's probably uninsured now.
Yeah.
Well, that is interesting. You want to go grab a bite here, and we can continue?
Yeah, I got you. So up to Washington, back in what it would have been, what, maybe 59 perhaps, to give, formally present to the National Air and Space Museum, which was the National Air Museum in those days, and which had the Quonset Hut, remember, from the castle,
mm-hmm.
we brought up I'm not sure what this
oh,
was,
yes.
a dynamic test or whatever, for the Redstone with the Explorer 1, at least a mock-up of the Explorer 1 satellite, which is still there. And we were talking on the stands, I remember backing up to the Quonset Huts, facing the Arts and Industry building, the old building. And the missiles, they had the missiles that were being given to the Smithsonian those days, outdoors. And we were on the bleachers, and I was, Von Braun gave a talk, I think Medaris gave a talk, maybe Buffett gave a talk, the Secretary of the Army. Anyway, when Von Braun was on the podium, he was the last guy to speak, I was sitting up either next or very close to Drucker. And when Von Braun stopped speaking, there was pandemonium again. They all rushed down to get his autograph. And he looked at me and said, nobody gives a goddamn about a Secretary of the Army. I remember that, right? Nobody gives a goddamn about a Secretary of the Army. And of course, he was totally right. He's a former governor of Michigan.
That's
he was totally, yeah. Oh, that's funny. I just thought of that.
Von Braun's celebrity.
Yeah.
Factor was so high.
Yeah. Nobody gives a goddamn about the Secretary of the Army.
That's good.
Well, I have another little story that Verna and I did some film strips. Educational film strip project.
Mm-hmm.
With involving Frank Rose. You remember Frank
Rose? Oh, so well.
And he was a delightful man. We really, was his wife named Tommy or something like that?
I don't know.
And anyway, we're doing this educational film strips for schools, and we got involved with that. And Bruno was, his job was to narrate it, but Rich Von Braun voice, my job was to put the whole thing together and get the illustrations and do most of the text. All was, however, with Von Braun's input, obviously.
Right.
And but that was under contract with Doubleday in New York.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing five of them, I think. We did History of Astronautics, maybe one and two. The Apollo story to the moon, just one. I think we did one on dividends from space and one stations in space. Five of them. And so the day came when it was time to record them, and Doubleday made arrangements with the best studios in the area to go to Nashville. So we get in the car, maybe it was Saturday, it was all our own time, you know. Went up to Nashville, and maybe we went up Friday, because we spent a night there, poor thing. Anyway, then Von Braun went into these studios where all the country singers are normally, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, again, he was again hero there, and all the country singers are gaping at him.
Oh, is that right?
He was there with doing the recording in the studio when he came out. Again, there were all these young scantily clad, some of them in long black stockings, that sort of thing, would
right.
Come up and ask for autographs. And I think it was the end of the day, we went back to the motel, and then you know, he made a comment. He said, Fred, it was a great day, wasn't it? He said, I think you and I really entered the wrong business. I always remember that little comment, you know, we should be in this business.
Not, not show business.
Yeah, we should be in show business, yeah. Yeah, that was another little story I always remember about Von Braun.
Oh, that's good. He did have this great sense of humor. Mm.
I remember the first time I got to know him well. I don't know if I even put that, probably not in the book. But I was a young guy. I worked for Reaction Motors Incorporated, and then I'd been given the job for the guiding missile division of the Republic on Long Island. And I got very active in those days, to be the early 50s, with a brand new, just created American Astronautical Society, and I was also quite active with the New York section of the American Rocket Society. So in those, we were able to get Von Braun and others on the board. We had Fred Durant on the board, I think we had Kraft Ehrlich on the board, Fred Singer on the board. We were able to get some big names on our board, the small, struggling society. And Von Braun was also active with the American Rocket Society, which is headquarters in New York in those days. So here I am, a young guy, but I got to know him, which was somewhat unusual, I guess, but I got to know him. And one day, he said that he was coming to...
Oh, thank you.
That's good.
Hey, we'll make... Yes.
He was coming to get it while it's hot, I guess.
How are you doing? Good. Nice to see you. All right.
Want to get one there? Well, I said, oh, sure.
Thanks.
And one day he said he was afraid I'm going to be coming up to whatever companies on the Long Island, and where shall I stay? So here I'm a young guy. He said, we had a big house there. Big house. This is a totally different story. But we had a big house and a large estate. And I'll tell you that story if it's of any interest to you. But
sure.
But why we had that estate.
Please.
And so I said, well, God, you can stay with us. We had a big house out there. And he said, okay. So here I am, a young guy, going to have Bruno Von Braun in my house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was would have been before he was back famous, before Explorer. This
mm-hmm.
was probably 1953 or 4. But, you know, those of us in the subby knew him.
When he'd done the Disney...
No, probably not. That, but he'd done Collier's.
Right, okay.
And he'd been at the Hayden Planetarium in New York. He'd known for that, and he was, you know, his name was getting out. So he came up, stayed there at night, and went driving into New York, I guess, whatever. I didn't even like to tell him into New York the next day, and it was a Saturday. What? And then he said, called about 3 weeks later, and said, would you mind, I would like to be able to, I have another trip there, and I'd like to bring my wife. And so here I'm going to have Werner von Braun visit about in our house. A young guy, just starting out. So my wife and I organized tickets at the Carnegie Hall for them, and we gave a big dinner party for a mixed people, some from where I work, Republic, and some friends from Sperry and Grumman, I guess, in those days, but also we had a lot of friends who were, you know, in the business, cotton business, brokers. I remember one was a cotton broker who knew Milton Cumming well. But he was a friend of ours from a totally different region. He had nothing to do with Huntsville, but I remember asking him. And we had some bankers and, you know, a mixture of people, as you have with friends. And we, and Maria was with him, and we had, we were having this cocktail party at dinner. And I remember doing the reception, and one of them was just right in the center. Everybody was crowded around him, you know. And he was talking about God, and, you know, he talked about any and every subject.
Authoritative,
you know,
right.
And Marilla said, you better go over and talk to Mrs. Von Braun. She's as she was, you remember, you know, she was very retiring.
Yes.
And I always remember that there he was, this guy that was, you know, just very handsome, and all these people just drooling over him. You know, sophisticated,
of course.
Long Island people. We lived right in Oyster Bay, New York, and there was Von Braun up there.
This aristocratic figure who could hold his own with anyone.
We took him into the Carnegie Hall. We did a number of things for him. And then maybe on the third trip, one of the trips, he was staying with us, and we were going to have a board meeting of the American Astronomical Society. And we had our board meetings in those days at the Harvard Club. I remember the Harvard Club. And we had a ramp room there. And we're driving in to New York, and that's when he popped the question to me, would I be interested in joining him in Huntsville, Alabama? I'm a basically brought up in New England and New York, and in the early 50s, Alabama and Mississippi were probably the two states in the Union that you sort of knew less about as a Northerner, at least.
And didn't think you wanted
to go to. Well, not so much of that. It's just you didn't really know much of Georgia. With Atlanta, you certainly knew Florida.
Sure.
And the Carolinas, because everybody went through them on the way to Florida. And you knew the western states for all their, you know, their beautiful scenery in California.
But those question marks, right.
And I remember, I thought it was very strange, but I flew down to Alabama. I'd forgotten how we do it in those days, what planes they were, for the Piston of the early 50s. I remember we were Viscounts, but I think we went to Atlanta, and we landed, of course, downtown, the old airport.
Sure.
And they, my brother had a car, an army car, and took me to the Russell Erskine Hotel, and I learned very quickly that if you wanted to get a drink in Alabama, I guess, at least in Madison County, you had to become a member of the Rocket Club. Do you remember the Rocket Club? It cost $1.
And your first drink was free.
Yeah. So I joined the Rocket Club.
I do remember that very well.
Yeah.
That's funny. I'd forgotten about that. Oh, that's how that came about.
And of course, I was, you know, just mind-boggling when he went out to, this was building 4488. And so all the stuff he had on the walls, and lunar rovers, and Mars vehicles. And
you were hooked.
So I was hooked till I left Republic. And
now, was that visit was for an interview, if you will?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
you had not committed.
No, not
coming yet.
I remember.
Well, he'd had a good chance to see you operate, professionally and socially,
And it took me a while to get a house down there.
Gentlemen, doing okay?
We're fine. We're not enjoying this at all.
Oh, please do now.
I couldn't get a house. I would just stayed at the Russell Erskine Hotel. trying to find a house. And this probably has nothing to do with your book, but it's a little anecdote. It's early Alabama, early post-war, I mean, in this field. And so what they, I forgot who ran the control office in the Army, but I think Brenner or somebody told me, look, go to the control office and find out who the what officer is going to be transferring out of Redstone. You know, they do their tours here and then go off somewhere.
Sure.
I went to the control office and he said, well, there's a colonel, he's a colonel or major, what he was, you know, Lee James. Lee James has been transferred out, so did I have the address? I have the address. Went up the mountain, and Kathleen, I knocked on the door, and of course I didn't know Kathleen in those days. And she answered the door, and I said, I'm Frederick Ordway, and I'm coming down to work for Dr. Brown. I want to bring my family down. I understand your house will be going off the rental market, but you're being transferred. I said, that's true, my house will be transferred out. Well, would it be okay if I contacted the landlord? So she gave me the landlord of Ira Terry. Remember Ira Terry?
Oh, I do so well.
So I went down to D.T. Terry. Great is the power of cash, brother.
Yeah, so well.
And
right across the square.
He looked in there at me and told me, he said, well, that's, yeah, that's fine. You look like a nice fellow. And we negotiated the house on the mountain for $125 a month, I think it was.
Oh, is that right?
And he said, well, we signed lease. No, you know.
So Terry owned that.
He owned that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Terry, I now own it, you know. I bought it years later. But.
Terry is going to figure, my wife is kind of in trepidation about this. I'm going to work in some really interesting community little stories, some of them gossipy, some of them never published, into my Cummings book,
mm-hmm.
to try to capture the flavor of this cotton town.
Mm-hmm.
Ira Terry was born Iris Terry.
Oh, really?
He was a hermaphrodite.
Mm-hmm.
And he went off, they sent him off to boarding school. I don't know, it was a 12 or 13 year old girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it was either in Tennessee or Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't, but it was a little bit of a girl's trip and finishing school. And during when puberty struck, he suffered terrible abdominal and groin pains and went to a doctor, examined, Iris became Ira.
Well, his organs were inside.
His organs were inside, and the male dominated, and he ended up marrying his roommate, the girl, and this has never been, it's long been whispered around town, and I'm going to work this in, and I've talked to some local historians to confirm everything, and I've gotten a lot of detail. And it's one of many, many stories I'm going to work into the coming thing. And he was one of the sons of T.T.
T.T. Terry.
Ira became quite a successful entrepreneur, rental property, retail business.
Retail, yeah.
Ira had one half of the store and his brother had the other half of T.T. Terry's, the next generation.
Right.
But I'm going to work that into this damn book.
Yeah. Well,
along with a lot of other similar stories, some Huntsville scandals and some. Anyway, this town, everybody characterizes it as a sleepy cotton town back then, but there was a lot going on.
Peyton Place, Maine.
Exactly. So I'm gonna spice things up.
Good.
Although Cummings' life is spicy in a sense enough on its own, except there's no sex story involved there. But anyway, because I think to adequately present his life story, I have to set the stage for what kind of town this was, and what was going on, and a medal-winning Jersey
milk cows in the in the parlor of Antebellum Mansion, the Lily Flag story, and, which has been told so many times. Yeah. But anyway, I thought you'd be interested in
very much so, yeah.
In Ira's story.
Yeah, I guess you'll go into when you go to the pyramids, the suicide, and the.
Yes.
What about Harry and Sharon Redd?
You know, I'm aware of keeping that in.
I guess a delicate.
And on the warmer.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of stories from Harry about Von Braun that I think bear telling. One was a hunting trip, and
stamp collecting a hobby of his?
No, a hobby of mine.
Oh, I see.
I haven't done it so much now, but I had a pretty good handle on where countries were.
I was, as a boy, and I continued it, into adulthood, but some now I'm strictly coins and currency. But he's a great teacher of geography.
It is, and he I didn't know this about Bob. We got talking once, I think it was in Dallas after dinner. We were just sitting there together, and we started talking about countries and locations, and then we began to have a little competition in there. And I said, you would name us the seven seas, and of course they're the Ira Fura Sea and the other Malacca Sea and other seas what is now Indonesia. And then we talked about archipelagos and countries and what their capitals were. And he was very much on top of his game of that. That was another element of Vernon von Braun that
I've never heard that.
I used to like to talk about it. So we'd have a great time quizzing each other. Well, do you know the capital of Latvia? or do you know where such a big river is? Or do you know where the sea is? Or the Strait of Carpentia? Or whatever. And he would like that.
I played a little geography game with myself, and within the last week, I got to thinking about Disneyland. Oh, the Associated Press Managing Editors Convention this year was at Disneyland. I didn't go, but our managing editor did. And I suddenly questioned, well, how many countries in the world end in land? Ireland.
Oh, end of the word
in
land.
In the suffix land. And I came up with Ireland, Scotland. England. Iceland. Greenland.
Basutoland in South Africa.
I thought of even the Falkland Islands. In New Zealand.
New Zealand, yeah. Oh, just the land part.
I thought, well, that would make a nice little geography.
That would be quiz, yeah.
But I never knew that Brown had
That was a little quirk that I remember in traveling with him. We used to spend a lot of time doing talking about that.
Ruth von Sarma told me shared a little story about once they were on an outing on Gunnersville Lake.
Can I get you some coffee?
Would you like coffee?
You going to have any?
No, I'm not.
I've got a little wine. Okay. I think I'm in good shape,
Would you like for, would you care for dessert or?
No, I really don't need
any.
Well, I had a bit of cobbler, and I put it on the main plate.
Same here. Okay. I'm going to nurse that. Right, I'm going to nurse that a little while. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. And Ruth, what did...
They were on at Gunnersville Lake, and I think Dr. Von Braun had a houseboat.
He did have a houseboat.
Modest
down
houseboat
there,
over there. So there were some friends over there for a weekend, and Werner at one point decided to do some sunbathing on the roof of the houseboat and took one of his daughter's biology textbooks up with him. Never one to just waste time or trying to maximize his time, and read her biology textbook while he was sunning, and then came down talking about how interesting it was, and it has sparked all kinds of ideas to him, and I'm sure he knew most of the facts in there, but had been reminded of some things, which he started synthesizing.
Synthesizing, as he did, he would love to do that. He's so good at it.
Is that right?
Yeah. He did that, of course, in the Ford meetings out at the Arsenal. He would synthesize almost everything as he went around the lab leaders and lab directors, you know, and he would sort of synthesize what he remembered from the previous meeting, and how is this going, how is that going. He was very, very good at that. I'm trying to think, there's another thing that popped into my mind just recently.
He was awfully good at everyday analogies.
Oh, yeah.
Bringing it down.
Oh, yeah, I know what I was going to say. Did you?
Good.
Do you have the Berghaus book?
I'm familiar with it, and I don't have it.
Okay.
I probably should
get a
read
copy
that.
Of the Space and Rocket Center. That was a good. It was a biography. It wasn't in a serious biography, in the sense that say Ernst and I have done.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a good one. It was sort of a first-hand account. But the Eric Berghaus has got a lot of stories when he went hunting in Africa, in Alaska, and a lot of personal. And he traveled a great deal with him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Eric Berghaus was the chief editor. Wayne Parrish, is that the name? Remember Wayne Parrish?
Yes, I do.
He was the publisher of Aviation Publication in Boston that published Aviation, some not Aviation Week, but
another
competitor
mm-hmm.
to Aviation Week. And also published, which is now defunct, Missiles and Rockets, which was basically started by Eric Berghaus. And it came in the days when, I think, 1955, maybe whatever, when the space program, the missile program was growing, and it was a pretty good journal, magazine. And Eric Berghaus, Von Braun, and they became very good friends. Eric Berghaus is Norwegian-born, and became somewhat of a confidant, and was a tremendous supporter of the Von Braun and the Arsenal concept. So
mm-hmm.
it was Aviation Week on the one hand, which basically supported the Air Force and contracting out to industry and not doing things in-house.
Right.
And it was the Missiles and Rockets that was the conduit, would have been the conduit, for the Nickerson. You remember the Colonel
Oh, I do. Well,
you know that story. Yes. We cover it in
the Air Force Army struggle.
Yeah,
right.
But you want to look at Eric Berghaus, and it was Nickerson who brought to Eric Berghaus some still marked secret documents.
Oh,
and Eric, he was a journalist, but he was also a ferocious supporter of the Army and the Army's role in the space program and
mm-hmm.
so forth, but also a good friend of Von Braun's, and he just felt that his duty to Wernher von Braun was stronger than his journalistic desires for
mm-hmm.
school. So he advised von Braun and Madara said he had these documents, and of course Nickerson was—he wasn't court-martialed for it, but he was sent. He ended up in Panama Canal.
There was a court-martial.
He was a court-martial.
He was slapped on the wrist.
A court-martial. Yeah,
right.
Sorry, but it wasn't. He wasn't discharged. And I don't know if it's ever been determined.
Of course, Drew Pearson. Apparently Nickerson leaked
the stuff to Drew Pearson, but not the secret documents and marked secret. And if I've got to remember back there, I have a whole file on this stuff. But it seems to me that there was always doubt as to what Madaris's role was in this. Whether Madaris said, "Look, John, give it a shot. If you're successful, on this, fine. But if you're not successful, you didn't hear it.
We haven't talked.
We haven't talked. So I don't think that was ever. I know several important people didn't. When we were doing the book, I interviewed Bernard Schriever, the head of the became the head of the Air Force Systems Command. But he was the head of the Air Force Research and Development Command at the time. That was when the big battle between the Thor and the Cupid was going on. And he told me very clearly that he had tremendous respect for Wernher von Braun. He didn't trust
Madaris.
And I got the same message from Keith Glennon. It was Keith Glennon.
First NASA?
Yeah, first NASA administrator who was there with negotiating. You know, because Von Braun stayed in the Army for 2 years after NASA was created.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the Eisenhower administration, you know, authorized a transfer over. And Keith Glennon didn't like Medeiros either. He called him Martin that, and he was surrounded by 6 foot six bodyguards everywhere he went. And of course, he was. Did you know Medeiros well?
Yeah, well, no. I arrived in June 57, and he was in office and in power. And
yeah.
I observed him with
yeah.
his riding crop on
his
occasion.
Riding crop. He always had his gloves on his riding
exactly.
crop. Yeah.
That was the big M era.
What do they call it? Yeah, yeah. Swagger stick.
Swagger stick.
Yeah.
Right. I do remember that. He was quite an, a figure larger than life.
Oh, he was, yeah.
While he was here.
Interesting guy.
An alleged photographic memory, literally.
Yeah.
Probably much of that promulgated by him.
By him, yeah. But that's the part I don't. I'm not sure if anybody knows, just what role he had in the Nickerson. There are people, and there's a guy in Canada who claims to have